Reading from 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 7 to 15. You are so rich in all you have, in faith, speech, and knowledge, in your eagerness to help, and in your love for us. And so we want you to be generous also in this service of love. I'm not laying down any rules, but by showing how eager others are to help, I'm trying to find out how real your own love is. You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Rich as he was, he made himself poor for your sake, in order to make you rich by means of his poverty. My opinion is that it is better for you to finish now what you began last year. You were the first, not only to act, but also to be willing to act. On with it then, and finish the job. Be as eager to finish it as you were to plan it and do it with what you now have. If you are eager to give, God will accept your gift on the basis of what you have to give, not on what you don't have. I am not trying to relieve others by putting a burden on you, but since you have plenty at this time, it is only fair that you should help those who are in need. Then, when you are in need, they will help you. In this way, both are treated equally. As the scripture says, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little. Then reading from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 5, verses 21 to 43. Jesus went back across to the other side of the lake. There at the lakeside, a large crowd gathered around him. Jairus, an official of the local synagogue, arrived, and when he saw Jesus, he threw himself down at his feet and begged him earnestly, "My little daughter is very sick. Please come and place your hands on her so that she will get well and live." Then Jesus started off with him. So many people were going along with Jesus that they were crowding him from every side. There was a woman who had suffered terribly from severe bleeding for 12 years. Even though she had been treated by many doctors, she had spent all her money. But instead of getting better, she got worse all the time. She had heard about Jesus, so she came in the crowd behind him, saying to herself, "If I just touch his clothes, I will get well." She touched his cloak, and her bleeding stopped at once. And she had the feeling inside herself that she was healed by her trouble. At once, Jesus knew that power had gone out of him, so he turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" His disciples answered, "You see how the people are crowding you. Why do you ask who touched you?" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. The woman realized what had happened to her, so she came trembling with fear, knelt at his feet, and told him the whole truth. Jesus said to her, "My daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your trouble." While Jesus was saying this, some messengers came from Jairus' house and told him, "Your daughter has died. Why bother the teacher any longer?" Jesus paid no attention to what they said, but told him, "Don't be afraid, only believe." Then he did not let anyone else go on with him except Peter and James and his brother John. They arrived at Jairus' house, where Jesus saw the confusion and heard all the loud crying and wailing. He went in and said to them, "Why all the confusion? Why are you crying? The child is not dead. She is only sleeping." They started making fun of him. So he put them all out, took the child's father and mother and his three disciples, and went into the room where the child was lying. He took her by the hand and said, "Talitha koum," which means, "Little girl, I tell you to get up." She got up at once and started walking around. She was 12 years old. When this happened, they were completely amazed. But Jesus gave them strict orders not to tell anyone, and he said, "Give her something to eat." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
They are remarkable stories, and we'll come back to them in a little while. Paul, as he writes, continues to write to the church in Corinth, talks about them as being rich. "You are so rich," he says. And I'm not sure if people have ever talked to you about being rich, or if they've referred to you as being rich, or even if you have ever considered yourself to be rich. And there's times when we do these things and we see and wonder, you know, where we place ourselves. And one of the things that we sometimes do when we measure how we're tracking is that we rarely look back at people who have less. We tend to look forward at people who have more when we're trying to work out where we sit on the richness scale. We tend to look, oh, there's a lot of people with a lot more than we have. And yet when we look down, when we look back, especially globally, we would recognise just how much we have. But in some ways it's a little bit awkward, isn't it? Because even though globally we would be seen to be one of the richest nations in the world, and therefore us, some of the richest people, that still we find ourselves living in a society that costs an enormous amount to live in. So it's one of those things that comes and goes. But that's only if we look at our riches in terms of what we have in the bank. Why is it that the thing that continually amazes people who live in countries like ours, that when we see or visit places where people have so much less, somehow they seem to be far happier than us? Why is that? Because they find themselves rich in other ways and in other things. Perhaps it's family, perhaps it's the joy of life, perhaps it's any number of things that they find themselves feeling rich about. I've shared with you the story once or twice before about when our children were quite young, we visited a family who were, even relative to the people that in the church they worshipped in, quite well off. And we never used that kind of language or talked about people in that way. And as we were driving home, the little voice from our little girl in the back seat says, "Those people are really rich, aren't they?" And we, Linda and I, sort of glanced at each other in the front seat going, "Where is this coming from? From this child who's only 2.5 years old?" And so we just sort of, you know, we did the parent thing. You know the parent thing? "Oh, what makes you ask that question?" "They have 2 cats. Got to be rich if you've got 2 cats, right? Didn't matter about anything else, just the fact that they had 2 cats and we had no pets except for a bird probably at the time was about it. Erica always wanted a cat or a dog or something like that. She was 18 before it finally happened for her. So this idea of what makes us rich, of what gives us wealth, varies. And it comes in lots of different forms. The initial implication seems to say that they've been blessed with an incredible outpouring of Christ's love, and that we should be quick, just as Paul was encouraging them to be quick, to be loving towards the people that they came across. But it applies in so many other ways. How many of us simply limit the idea of the riches we have to the dollars in our bank account, rather than thinking about giftedness in one or more areas, the experiences that we've had bring richness to our lives and things that we can offer. Competence in a particular field, wisdom, time, prayerfulness, all of these things are part of the riches that we have at our disposal. Especially in this era in which we live, when you talk to people who have time to give, isn't that one of the rarest commodities we come across these days? People who are willing to give their time. All of these things are things that can impress upon us. We're reminded in the scriptures of lots of different times of that idea that says, to whom much is given, much is expected. So that's not limited to one aspect of our lives. There are all sorts of things that we have that we can share, that we have much of. The encouragement too is to maintain the enthusiasm for a task that we might have begun, so that that task can be completed. And certainly for Paul, as we remember thinking back to the readings and passages that we've heard from this particular letter over the last couple of weeks, much of that has to do with an enthusiasm to share the hope that we find in Jesus. That should always be something that we're keen to do. However, we find ourselves wondering at some of these ideas that come through. The idea that God will accept your gift according to what you give, not what you don't have. One of the things that happens as we get on in life a little bit is there are times when we find ourselves lamenting the things that we can't do anymore. Is that right? I used to be able to do so much. Now I can't do this and I can't do that. That's one of those things. And we don't have to be terribly far in life for that to affect us. Have an accident or an injury or something that limits the way you can do things now. You know, you can have someone quite young saying, oh, but I can't do the things that I used to. But Paul, in a sense, is saying, let's not focus on what we can't do. Let's focus on what we can do. There's still a great deal we can do. Perhaps if we can't get out as much as we used to, we can focus more attention on prayer or contacting people by phone or staying in touch in some other way, perhaps to encourage other people, to support them, to help them on their way through. What gift do we give to God? What gift do we give from all the richness that we have? Because one of the other things that Paul says in this particular part of his letter, which sounds a little bit odd, is that God will accept your gift on the basis of what you have to give, not on what you don't have. Which leads me to a kind of an odd point, really. What is it that we give to God? What gifts do we give? We talk about giving our gifts for the work of God often. Doesn't that mean that through us, God is the giver? That if we give ourselves or our time, our energy or whatever richness we have, that that's actually being given away on God's behalf? How then is it that if we give away whatever it is, time, money, talent, capacity on God's behalf, that God also accepts the gift or receives the gift? How can God be the giver and the receiver of the gift? So here's a thought. The writer to the Hebrews says in chapter 13, don't neglect to show hospitality. By doing this, some have welcomed angels as guests without knowing it. So those people, as they gave their hospitality on God's behalf, gave it back to God as they came in the form of angels, perhaps. Or at least without them knowing it. Somehow God is present also in the receiver as much as in the giver. Mother Teresa's, one of her famous quotes, says that she cared for Jesus in some of his most disgusting of disguises. And if that's not an idea you're familiar with or a quote you've heard before, perhaps it puts it in this little bit of context. Jesus says in the parable of the sheep and the goats, "When you did it for the least of these, you did it for me." That's exactly what Mother Teresa was living out. Every time I do something for this person, no matter how distraught they might be, how struck down by life they might be, that I'm actually doing it for Jesus. And that's exactly what her quote means. "I care for Jesus in some of his most disgusting of disguises," was her comment. Because remember too that Mother Teresa, as a young woman, you may or may not be aware of this, actually was part of a very wealthy family. So when she responded to her calling, primarily initially to be a teacher, she gave up an enormous amount to do that. And then for her, there was a calling within a calling. So as she journeyed through those poorest parts of India, but primarily at that point believing she was called to teach, then within that felt drawn towards caring for these people who needed so much. So a person who gave out of her richness, her time, rich, great resources of compassion, energy, drive, were the things that she gave to God's work, and through whom many were blessed. Jesus says in the parable of the sheep and the goats that when you did it for the least of these, you did it for me. Folks, as we reach out, as we're doing things for people on God's behalf, God is also the receiver, because God is present in the person that we help. God wants us to be people that share what we have, no matter what it is. Whatever it is that you've been blessed with, and believe me, there are many. You may be rich in dollars, or it might be a skill, or it might be time, it might be capacity, it may be things you did during your working life that you're not using so much anymore. All of these things are things that you can offer. How might it be that God would want you to share whatever it is that you have that is excess to your need, so that others can be uplifted, so that in turn you can be uplifted by those who are willing to share something with you? Paul says, "I'm not asking you to do this to take the burden off others, but just so that we recognise that we play our part in what God would do." In the gospel reading, and we spent some time talking about these ideas last week, we find Jesus again crossing the lake. Remember that conversation from last week, those that were here? So he's coming back now from the non-Gentile, from the Gentile side of the lake back to the Jewish side of the lake. And as he arrives, once again, he's mobbed by people. The story tells us that almost as soon as he got out of the boat, the crowd is there. How annoying would that be? You know, you've been on a trip, you've been away, you've been engaging in, you know, all sorts of things while you've been there. And then aren't there those times when you come back from being away and you think, oh, it'll be good just to be home for a while and just to be us. So Jesus arrives back from the lake, he steps out of the boat, and Mark tells us the crowd is there already, mobbing him, asking him questions. The leader of the synagogue comes and says, "My little girl is really sick, close to death perhaps. Can you help?" Jesus' response, out of his richness, "Of course I will." And they head off. And this is one of those times when we see this kind of narrative in the scriptures from time to time, in a number of different places, where you find a story within a story. Sometimes two or three within a series of stories. Like a story begins, two or three little stories happen in the beginning, the story ends. And it happens here. It was a way of writing that was not uncommon at this time. So as Jesus is on the way to heal Jairus' daughter, with the crowd crushing in, a woman who's been ill for the same period of time as the little girl has been alive. Did you notice that in the story? A woman who's been ill for 12 years and the little girl is 12 years old. She thinks, if I just touch his cloak, I don't need to talk to him. I don't need him to see me. If I just touch the hem of his garment, I'll be well. And so this woman who, according to the local custom, has taken an enormous risk by even leaving her home, finds herself in the midst of a jostling crowd, reaching for the hem of Jesus' garment. And she touches it. And immediately she notices a change in her. And remarkably, Jesus notices something of a change in him. The story says, I felt the power go out of me. Who touched me? Have you ever tried to make your way through a crowd? Maybe you've been at a big stadium and you've gone to get something to eat or drink. Or maybe you're in the crush at half time. Or on the way in and out of a concert hall. Any number of places. Turning up to watch a child graduate. Any number of places where there's big crowds of people. People are jostling you and bumping into you all the time, aren't they? We've just heard the description of what Jesus has arrived to. He's landed back at the lake, big crowds of people. You can only imagine as the whispers went around, he's going to heal Jairus' daughter, let's go. They all would have been jostling alongside. And every time I read this story, I think that's the most ridiculous of questions almost. When Jesus turns around and says, someone touched me. Well, of course someone's just touched you. Look where you're standing. Can imagine being one of the disciples alongside. How are we supposed to answer that question? Somebody touched you. It would have been like this. But he has sensed that someone in need had touched him. And he felt the power go out of him. And he turns and he applauds the woman. Your faith has made you well. No, how dare you? No, you know, what are you doing? None of that. Just applauds her for her faith. Blesses her. Encourages her on her way. And then the crunch of the story comes in some ways, doesn't it? As he continues along the way, the people come and say, you're too late. She's dead. I can't imagine what might have gone through Jairus' mind at that point. But Jesus' response, no, she's not. She's just sleeping. And they laugh at him. Ridicule him. So do you remember what happens in the story? He takes none of them with him. Just Jairus, perhaps Jairus' closest supporters who'd been there with him, and three of the disciples, and they go on. And when they get to the house, it continues. The ridicule continues. So only the little girls, father, mother, and the three disciples go into the space. And in that moment, according to the story, he raises the child. Little girl, get up. And then that strange comment at the end, don't tell anyone. No one has to be told. No one has to be told anything. As soon as that little girl walks out of the room, everyone is told, are they not? No one has to say a word. The miracle that's taken place will do the job all by itself. The closest thing that I've ever heard or understood that comes even within, you know, a bull's roar of that experience was quite a significant Indigenous worship group that operated in South Lismore, and they had a testimony time each week in their service where if you know, God moved in someone's life or if someone had experienced a miracle of some sort, they'd get up and they'd testify about it, was the kind of language they used. And there was one particular old gentleman who worshipped in that group with them, elderly Indigenous guy. And it was quite strange because I was there one night and they came to this time and I looked around to see what the stories were, and this guy stood up in his chair and he held his hand up and everyone went nuts. And he just sat down, didn't say a word. So when I talked to them afterwards, I said, "What's going on with the guy that stood up and waved?" He said, "I used to be in a wheelchair." He doesn't have to say anything. Just the fact that he stands up says it all. When that little girl walked out of that room, what do you think the people who had ridiculed Jesus, who had laughed at him when he said she was just asleep, what do you think would have been going through their minds, through their hearts, through their souls? Perhaps they, like the disciples in the boat in the story we heard last week, were a little bit terrified. Who is this person that can bring the presence of God into our house? Who is this person that transforms lives? We've seen it twice in a day. Folks, this is the Christ who loves you. This is the Christ who calls you. The one who has the capacity to restore you and raise you up. But not just for our own sake. So that out of the richness that we have in our lives, in whatever form it is, that we can contribute that to Christ's mission, so that a difference might be made in the lives of others. Will we trust Jesus to be who he promises to be for us, in the same way that he was for the woman and the child in the story? Jesus is someone who can be approached and asked for help. Jesus is one who will listen and respond. Jesus is one who is capable of more than we ask or imagine. Jesus is someone with whom only a passing contact could change a person's life forever. And as I said, someone who can heal, restore, and resurrect our lives. Let's never forget what Christ has done for us, and always allow that to be the motivation for engaging out of our richness on God's behalf with others. Amen.